This is number 0092, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0092. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dr. Derek Podorenko, who is the author of First You Smoke, Now You Live. Is it possible these days for people to quit smoking cold turkey?
Finally, society is starting to shift it from it being a habit or a lifestyle choice to a true blue addiction. And it's true, you'll always hear the stories of individuals, oh yeah, I woke up one morning, threw them in the garbage, and I walked away, and it was no big deal. But, you know, in 2011, those individuals that are truly addicted to nicotine and tobacco products are truly hooked and really need extra help to get it done these days.
Bob DiRigo-Jones, creator of the Wacky Warning Label Contest, is on the program. He's also the host of the Let's Be Fair segments that you hear on this show each week. Was he ever afraid that he might one day run out of Wacky Warning Labels?
Halfway through to where we are now, 7 years ago into the contest, we got a call from Time Warner Books. They wanted to have a working title be the 101 Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, and at the time I only had 50, and I was really worried I wasn't going to get enough to fill the book, but we had no trouble doing that and are going even stronger today. We found more warning labels than I ever could have imagined.
Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
I'm Stuart Nellman. On this edition of Book Banter, I explore the gritty, violent world of the notorious West End Gang in Montreal's Irish Mafia, along with two of my favorite mafia-related books. It's an offer you can't refuse, and it's all happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, including, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0092, is my young nephew, Jordan Alleen. Thank you very much, Jordan, for being the guest later on this edition of the Stuff File program. Love you. Now, let's get to the Stuff File news, shall we? In Taranaki, New Zealand, one farmer has had a most amazing chain of events that's downright freakish. A motorist was driving down a road near the farm when he hit a cow head-on. The animal was thrown over the top of the car, peeling back the hood and shattering the windshield. Thus, the driver couldn't see, which caused him to smash into a power pole. This caused an electrical surge to race along the wires into the farmer's barn, where it blew up a metal box and set the barn on fire. However, the same power surge also melted a copper water line directly above it, which caused water to start spraying everywhere, which put out the very fire it had started. Try making that happen again in a million years. As for the driver, he'll be fine. As for the cow, well, beef. It's what's for dinner. And bad is finding out your Chevy Blazer is on fire. Gee, the aptly named Chevy Blazer, I guess. Worse is running out to check on your burning Chevy Blazer and forgetting about the pot that you left on the stove that proceeds to set your house on fire. It happened in Tunnelton, Indiana, and Assistant Volunteer Fire Chief Matt McDonald said the car was destroyed, but fortunately the house was not seriously damaged. The cause of the car fire is still unknown. And that's another one of those coincidences for the books, I guess. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has filed a lawsuit against Starbucks Coffee Company on behalf of a woman who claims she was fired from an El Paso, Texas coffee shop because she's a dwarf. Elsa Sallard requested a stool or a stepladder, a small stepladder, to help her do her job, such as working the cash register and preparing beverages. Starbucks allegedly refused and then fired her on the grounds that she could be a danger to customers and employees. The EEOC, in the lawsuit, claims that Starbucks failed to provide reasonable accommodations for Elsa and are in clear violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The EEOC is asking for a jury trial, and the jury would determine the amount of compensation, if any. Starbucks won't comment. So basically, what we have here is Starbucks is being taken to court over dwarf tossing. Meanwhile, in Daytona Beach, Florida, 68-year-old Daniel Pacheco allegedly got very angry with his girlfriend, also age 68, because she bought milk after he already had bought some. So he pulled out a kitchen knife and stabbed her. Fortunately, she was reported in good condition at Halifax Health Medical Center. Pacheco himself was treated for a possible overdose of Tylenol and had surgery on some tendons as he also cut himself in the on the lower arms and wrists. The stabbing happened at the couple's lovely mobile home. Got milk? Stand back. I have a knife. And might want to rethink your summer vacation plans. Good news, the town of Logan, Ohio, has opened the Pencil Sharpener Museum. Yeah, that's right. Tourism officials have made a point of displaying the thousands of pencil sharpeners collected by the Reverend Paul Johnson, an Ohio minister who died last summer. Reverend Johnson had kept his collection in a small shed he called his museum. But a new home for his more than 3,400 sharpeners was dedicated inside a regional welcome center. Paul started collecting after his wife gave him a few pencil sharpeners as a gift in the late 1980s. He kept them organized by categories including cats, Christmas, and Disneyland. The oldest is 105 years old. Well, everybody needs a hobby, I guess. And we'll need to make it a rule that 27-year-old Joshua Monin gets no more pencils. Maybe he's somebody who shouldn't also visit the Pencil Sharpening Museum. Earlier this week, Monin allegedly stabbed his attorney in the neck with a pencil in Snohomish County, Washington. He was in jail attending a court hearing via video when the attack happened, and he used a golf pencil. Wow. You can barely write with those things, never mind stab someone. Anyway, the attorney was not seriously hurt and continued working with other clients after a nurse who works at the jail examined him. But here's the kicker. This was the second time Monson had done this in the same week. He attacked his previous lawyer, Thomas Cox, earlier in the week. Cox originally planned to represent Monson still, even though he was stabbed by the guy. But Monson had a new lawyer by Friday. He's facing charges of methamphetamine possession and second-degree murder. He will now get to enjoy all subsequent court appearances in the comfort of a restraint chair. Meanwhile, I'm sure his lawyer should probably come to work wearing metal turtlenecks. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? May 31st is World No Tobacco Day. The World Health Organization designates that day to raise global awareness about the destructive nature of tobacco addiction. 5 million people die every year from smoking. Derek Poterico is a family physician based in Nanaimo, British Columbia. He's the author of First You Smoked, Now You Live, and he joins us on the line right now. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We come across people all the time who try to quit smoking. Some are very successful. They can do it cold turkey. Some try over and over and over again and never succeed. What's the difference between those two types of people?
Well, that's a great question. I think that finally, society is starting to shift it from it being a habit or a lifestyle choice to a true blue addiction. And it's true, you'll always hear the stories of individuals, oh yeah, I woke up one morning, threw them in the garbage, and I walked away, and it was no big deal. But in 2011, those individuals that are truly addicted to nicotine and tobacco products are truly hooked and really need, or usually need, extra help to get it done these days.
You see a lot of television commercials, too, for various anti-smoking or kicking smoking aids, and some of them advocate the fact that they use nicotine to help you kick the habit. Some say, oh, they don't use nicotine to help kick the habit. is there an advantage to one or the other? Do these things actually work?
That's what we're all about, just to, you know, with the World No Tobacco Day coming up, is just raising our public education around nicotine addiction and how to kick it, so to speak. And it's true, you know, if you look at these patch ads and other things on TV, which do have some impact, but if you hear the stats, they'll go, it doubles your chances to quitting smoking. And truth be known, that the average number for a person to quit cold turkey is about 5 or 6%. So truth be known, that it only raises it to about 11 to 12%. Therefore, those people that use patches, 80+% are still smoking at a year. It's better than nothing, but it sort of gives a false sense of success. And that's why individuals, and that's why I'm here, talking about this stuff, is to give people hope that there are other methods, including the patch. As I said, I don't sort of discount it, but other methods available. And that's where behavioral therapy comes into play with this addiction.
Is it fair to say that for someone who wants to quit smoking, it will take more than one attempt to be successful?
You've done your research well. Yeah, it usually takes 4 to 5 good quit attempts for the average person to quit smoking. Yes, you'll hear about the guy that does it in the garbage once. And then there's other individuals that will take, when they come to see me in my smoking cessation clinic, sometimes they're 6, 7, 8 times over, and they've been to laser, and they've had all sorts of other types of methodologies and have not been successful. So never quit on quitting, to everyone out there. But the thing is, it usually takes about 4 or 5 good attempts before you get the job done.
Are people who are addicted to nicotine, those who smoke, are they generally addictive personalities? In other words, are they easily addicted to other things, or is smoking it?
If we're able to sort of cut brains open, we just can't do that yet, or biopsy brains, that there is a subset of individuals that have receptors, dopamine receptors in their brains that are more, in tune with nicotine and other substances. So that's why, you see family histories, individuals that might be addicted to tobacco or alcohol, and it runs sort of through generations. So there is some truth in that we do have the, subset of populations that can be more addicted. And interesting enough, for those who smoke and are pregnant, there's now some good evidence that if you do smoke when you're pregnant, you're sort of tuning your baby's brain to becoming addicted to nicotine down the road. So I said, as a physician trying to help people, live healthier lives, we really ask individuals to abstain from smoking through pregnancy or for the rest of their lives, depending on where they're at in their sort of existence.
When I was growing up, and I had this conversation just yesterday with a friend of mine who is a smoker and someone I basically grew up with, and we were discussing the dangers of smoking, and she was telling me, well, we really didn't know how bad smoking was when we were growing up. And I said, well, yeah, we did. What we didn't know at the time, I think, was the dangers of secondhand smoke. And now I'm hearing something about third-hand smoke.
Yeah, you do your homework well. Yeah, third-hand smoke is sort of smoke off of hair and clothing and other things. And yeah, it's just bad stuff. It's funny when you sort of talk about when we were kids and the dangers weren't as well sort of propagated. I've got some really neat video. You can go to YouTube, from the sort of late 50s. There's doctors on TV smoking cigarettes and telling people, hey, it's after a long, hard day, come home and smoke your, whatever brand they were selling. So, it's been such a culture shift. The 60s, there was some sort of definite, oh, maybe this is not good for us. And then 70s and then the 80s, the big tobacco reps were saying, oh, no, it's not addictive. And then now we're obviously into this, hey, this is an addiction. It's a worldwide addiction. We talk about 5 million people dying from tobacco addiction every year, and terrorism, which I know is on everybody's mind with the recent capture and killing of bin Laden, but terrorism kills maybe 2,000, 3,000 people a year, and that's still numbers. We're talking 5 million die from this addiction every year. It just sort of boggles the mind that we as a world haven't really keyed in on that yet.
You mentioned what we knew about it in the 60s. I distinctly remember growing up in the 60s and seeing a commercial with the late actor William Talmadge, who played Hamilton Burger on Perry Mason.
And, oh, yeah?
Yeah, and he was dying of lung cancer, and a commercial that he created and had on that ran up to his illness and passed into his death. A commercial ran about the evils of smoking, and of course the same thing happened years later with Yul Brynner.
That was in the 60s. Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yul Brynner was a little later, but Yul Brynner also did a commercial that only started airing after his death. I want to talk a little bit about your book, which I alluded to earlier, which is First You Smoke, Now You Live. What will one find out by reading your book, and what is the significance for you of the title?
Sure. And the title is, you know, everybody says, what an odd title for a book. But, you know, it's one to inspire in a sense that, you know, whoever chooses this addiction, I mean, they choose it for various reasons. Sometimes it's peer pressure when you're a teenager, and then it goes into other sort of behaviors. But, I mean, that book in itself is a culmination of the number of years. We started our clinic here in Nanaimo back in 2004, and it's true, the wisdom of many patients that we've helped with smoking is in those pages. Truth is, you know, smoking addiction is near and dear to my heart. I mean, I've watched family members pass away from this addiction, and I said, as a physician, I see it every day with my own patients. So it's one of these things, as a culture, even medical practice, we're not doing enough for this addiction, because in the end, smoking, if a person quits smoking, they're doing more good for their body than, you know, we talk about cholesterol and hypertension and treating blood pressure. Quitting smoking has more health impact than any of those other things combined. I mean, it's that powerful. So as a physician, that's why I've sort of spent a little bit more time and spent a number of years of writing that book. And that, as I said, that book is basically the smoking program that we do here in Nanaimo. It's a 7-week program. We don't call it your quit day. So basically work on getting tools, cognitive behavioral tools, up to the 4th week, and then that becomes your quit day. But like I say, we don't say quit. We use, you know, we change language and call it a person's freedom day. And as I said, there's support to continue along those lines to stay a non-smoker for life.
You mentioned dealing with people in your practice and also having dealt with this in your personal life with family members. In both cases, do you find that the people who are smokers, even if they come to you and they want to quit, are they in denial about what the damage the cigarettes are doing to them? Or is it just that difficult to break the habit?
Well, as I said, you use the habit term. As an addiction goes, insight and a few other things can sometimes be impaired to a degree. I think a lot of individuals that are smokers know the writing on the wall, but it's interesting because, you know, you see, if you've seen cigarette packages, especially here in Canada, you know, they've got the awful pictures of the heart or the brain that's bleeding and cancer in the lungs. I mean, it's pretty awful, awful, gruesome pictures. They've done some studies where they've scanned individuals who are smokers and when they look at these pictures, it doesn't register. So it's a very interesting, you know, whether it's is it denial? I don't know if that's a good word, because like you say, I'm always here to inspire people to quit, because they say at any given time, smokers, 70% want to quit. It's just finding the tools. And as I said, you know, there's a lot of misinformation about the patches. You know, most of my patients, when they come and see me, they've done the patch and they've been unsuccessful. And it's that whole failure mindset. I tried it, I didn't do it, and I'm not going to try again. Well, look at the numbers. The numbers of the patch just doesn't work that well. But if you put the patch with medication, with the cognitive behavioral therapy program, which is basically the book, or as I said, we have many quit lines and other resources on the Internet, then a person's chance of quitting and being successful for life increases greatly. So I guess that's, you know, a long-winded answer to your question. Hopefully I answered it.
And you are the medical director of the Central Island Smoking Intervention Clinic, and people can go to the website, which is www.cisic.ca, and I'll put a link in on my site to that. What will people find when they go to that site?
Well, basically information about the clinic, how to get a copy of the book if they're so interested. And then we did a fun video, if you have a chance to take a peek, myself and our town's respiratory specialist, our town's lung doctor, we did a tongue-in-cheek video. It's called Quit Quitting. And basically, it's he comes into the hospital, and I help him quit smoking. And in his journey as a becoming a non-smoker, he goes through some trials and tribulations with a bit of, like, say, humor along the way. So that's actually on the website, as well as many other links. I mean, I have a BC sort of viewpoint, because here in BC we do have a couple of resources that are free to our sort of residents. They're on that website as well. So that's, and I said my email's there. So that, you know, if there's somebody that's in your audience that wants to ask a question or two, I'm very happy by email to be approached.
The book is called First You Smoked, Now You Live, and it's written by Dr. Derek Poderico. I thank you very much, Derek, for being on the program with us.
Thanks for your time, Peter. I appreciate it.
Dr. Derek Poderico, author of First You Smoked, Now You Live. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0092, and you'll find links to Derek's website.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, our good friend Bob DiRigo Jones will be along to talk about the wacky warning labels. You know, it's been 14 years since that's all been going on. And Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Now, either this guy is just an idiot, or the bar has been raised for empty gumball machine obsessions. In Martins Ferry, Ohio, police say surveillance video shows our suspect hurling a brick or a rock through a storefront window, then entering and running directly to a 4-foot-tall gumball machine at the back of the store. Note that said gumball machine has neither any gumballs nor any money in it. But our guy grabs it anyway and runs back out the same window. He didn't bother to touch any of the liquor bottles or cartons of cigarettes displayed nearby. Police are looking for the suspect but can't figure out any reasonable motive. And since we don't have any kind of motive, we can't officially make this guy the idiot of the day. But fear not, we do have one of those later on in the program. Okay, so what's better, Ford or Chevy? Well, that debate has been going on for decades, but in Gordon County, Tennessee, real men settle that argument with knives. Police say 21-year-old Zachary Wood and several friends were driving their four-wheel drive vehicles in a field when the classic Ford or Chevy argument broke out. Wood and another young man, whose name hasn't been released, began a fist fight, and then Wood pulled out a knife and stabbed the guy. The victim was rushed to the hospital with serious injuries. Mr. Wood was rushed to the Gordon County Jail, where he was charged with aggravated assault. Really? A knife fight over Ford versus Chevy? Wow. Okay, now, I actually drive a Ford, and I only got it about 3 weeks ago, and it's my first one. And I really enjoy it. It's a brand new 2011 Ford Edge. Still, I'm not about to get into a fight over it. Not even in the most remote sense of the word. If you want to tell me that the new car that I just got sucks, go right ahead. I love it. I don't care if you don't love it. Anyway, is there anything that people won't fight over? In Tuscany, four people required hospitalization after a fight broke out between family members over, are you ready for this? How thick a ham should be sliced. The fight began after a 50-year-old woman complained that the ham slices being cut by the butcher's assistant were too thick. The ensuing all-out brawl involved the shop's assistant's father, as well as the woman's husband and two sons. Police were called and three ambulances were required at the scene. Wow, suddenly the Ford versus Chevy battle sounds refreshingly normal. And a fight broke out in a low-security area at New York's Erie County Correctional Facility. The cause of the fight, a spokesperson said, appears to be the dissemination of food products. An inmate was in the best position to break up the fisticuffs, but when he tried, he was punched in the face, knocking out a tooth. Why didn't jailers intervene? Well, because they were the ones fighting. The two correctional officers, who together have more than 55 years of experience between them, and I'm beginning to doubt that, were allegedly fighting over a bag of potato chips. Officer Lawrence Mule, the aptly named Lawrence Mule, because he's as smart as one, was suspended for 60 days and must attend an anger management program. Officer James Conlin was suspended without pay until he retires next month. Bet you can't eat just one. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest with me here on the Stuff File program, I being Peter Anthony Holder, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, then you know how I feel about blindly following zero-tolerance rules. Well, here's the latest asinine example of it. Graham Dennis kept a penknife in his gym bag to repair his lacrosse stick. Teammate Casey Edsel carried a lighter for the same purpose. The coaches at Eastern Maryland High School knew about both tools, students say, but when school officials searched the boys' gym bags on the bus as they were heading toward a game, they found the items. School officials declared the penknife a deadly weapon and the lighter an explosive device. Really? A lighter? Per the district's zero-tolerance policy, the boys were suspended. Dennis for 10 days and Edsel for one. Wow, only one day for an explosive device? Anyway, school officials also called police, and Dennis, age 17, was taken away in handcuffs to face weapons charges. He could also get up to 3 years in prison. Now, 50 parents showed up at the school board meeting to protest the suspension. Good for them. Because these kids didn't do anything wrong, said one, but the board refused to allow them to speak. Parents demand school administrators to use discretion rather than slapping every student with the worst-case penalty. That's what they're paid to do, said Laura Dennis, who happens to be Graham's mother. Nope, said Lynn Duncan, who is Talbot County Supervisor of Student Services. Our policy doesn't allow for it. Wow, so zero thinking isn't just my snarky comment about this story. Apparently, as far as this school is concerned, zero thinking is the official school policy. How asinine can they be? I almost made the whole lot idiots of the day. I really, really wanted to do that, but I'm restraining myself. I'm holding myself back a little bit. And the idiot of the day is coming up a little later on. Wait for it. In the meantime, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Bob DiRigo Jones is a regular contributor to this very show. Each week, you hear his Let's Be Fair segments on this program. He's also the guy behind the annual Wacky Warning Labels Contest, which proves just how far companies will go to avoid being sued by consumers for stupid mishaps. If you heard last week's show, then you know that the nominations for the 14th annual contest have been announced. So Bob, who is also the author of Remove the Child Before Folding, 101 Stupidest, Silliest, Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, is on to talk with us about this year's entries. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you back on the program again. The first question I want to ask, I think I already know the answer to, because it's a question that I have to deal with each week doing odd news stories, and that is, have you ever thought when you started this oh so many years ago that maybe one day you'd run out of wacky warning labels?
I really did, to tell you the truth. When we were about halfway through to where we are now, 7 years ago into the contest, we got a call from Time Warner Books, who had heard us on the radio and thought this would be a great topic for a book. And they wanted to have a working title be the 101 Wackiest Warning Labels Ever. And at the time, I only had 50. And I was really worried I wasn't going to get enough to fill the book. But we had no trouble doing that and are going even stronger today. We found more warning labels than I ever could have imagined.
Now, has your contest or the notoriety of the things you talk about, both in book form, on radio, and through the contest that you have, has it had any effect, or have you heard anything from companies who say, you know, maybe we should think about things differently, or yes, we see the absurdity of what we have to do?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was just speaking with a reporter from Associated Press about the same thing today. I don't know that we see any fewer warning labels today, or if we have any fewer lawsuits. But what we do see through anecdotal evidence and through some reports we see in papers is that people are becoming more aware that all the lawsuits that have created the need for these warning labels are piling costs on consumers in a way that we all pay. There's over the years, the lawsuit problem in North America and generally in the United States has only been a problem for about the last 30 years. It never used to be like this. Our grandparents didn't need to be warned, for example, that if you used a scooter, it would move when used, which is an actual warning label from our contest. So what happened in our culture that created the need for common sense warnings, a warning on a fishing lure that says harmful if swallowed, is in our book. And it started with the change in how law schools were teaching their law school students, and it filtered in through society in a number of different ways. And so many people who are listening to us now grew up thinking that lawsuits over such simple things as spilled coffee and a lot of the other examples I talk about in my weekly radio commentaries are just normal. And what we're trying to do is create awareness that it's not normal, it's not accepted, and it's not like this in most parts of the world. And in order for us to get control of this, we just need to become more aware that we can get rid of the frivolous lawsuits and still leave the courts for all the legitimate ones.
Now, again, this is the 14th annual contest, and you do have this year's nominees. Who are the top five finalists? I know you alluded to it in last week's program, but let's go through them.
Yes, some great ones. There's a one of my favorites is a label that was found on a common dust mask. This is, if people are trying to visualize this, this is the dust mask that you might remember somebody like Michael Jackson wearing when he was out in public, you know, and you'd say, why is he wearing that dust mask? Well, this is the type you might wear when you're painting. It says, warning, does not supply oxygen. Well, of course it doesn't. So I don't know where that came from. A label on a cover for a hot tub says, warning, remove safety cover from spa when in use. Well, good advice there. How about the instructions that come with a ballpoint pen? And there's a story behind this one, but the warning says, pen caps can obstruct breathing. Keep out of mouth. So in other words, don't swallow the pen cap, stupid. And a label on an ad for a leather handgun holder. It's designed to look like a daily planner, kind of like a Franklin planner. It says, warning, for gun only, not a functional day planner. And finally, one of my other favorites is a bicycle brochure with pictures of small children riding bikes. Okay, most of the bikes have training wheels, but it carries this disclaimer. Warning, the action depicted in this brochure is potentially dangerous. The riders seen are experienced experts or professionals.
Are there pictures of children on that?
They're all children, and that's why it's become so hard for lawyers at companies to keep up with where they might be sued next that they put these on. It's like many of us have seen the ads on television for a car company, and you got this car skidding down the highway, and there's always a disclaimer that says, trained expert, do not try this on public roads, something like that. Well, most of the lawsuits that happen today in our society are – with the basis of the lawyer saying you failed to warn. Failure to warn is a reason to sue anybody that makes a product or provides a service. So in order to try to avoid being the target of a failure to warn lawsuit, you'll find product makers putting these kinds of warnings that are obviously common sense, but again, common sense is kind of at a premium in some of the courts around the country.
Well, I was about to say, isn't there a place where common sense comes in? If someone can find a lawyer, first of all, who says, yeah, I'll take this case on, shouldn't we at least be able to say that there's a judge out there who says, you know, you're wasting my time?
Yes, and most judges, to their credit, will. The problem is that there are enough judges out there who are, for whatever reason, they just want to give everybody their day in court. They want to look like they're not denying somebody justice, will allow lawsuits to go forward that should not. And as my friend Philip Howard, who wrote the book The Death of Common Sense, The Death of Common Sense, says, is that judges are supposed to be the gatekeepers to the courts. There's some cases that should never make it into court. And this is where a lot of courts have failed in their responsibility to us as consumers and as taxpayers, is in an effort to bend over backwards to make sure that all victims have their day in court. What they've done is made victims of innocent people who are being sued and are therefore encouraging more frivolous lawsuits, so that we've gotten to the point in the United States where our tort system costs twice as much per GDP when you compare it to any other country in Europe or Asia. And that's a significant burden on consumers. It's almost like saying that you're starting two steps behind everyone when you're competing for jobs in America because you have all the costs of these lawsuits. Now, that's comparing apples to apples. That's saying if you got rid of all the cases and got us to the point where we had the same numbers of lawsuits in other industrialized countries, we're still twice as much and as expensive.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there was a story behind the pen cap one.
Yes.
Beyond the warning itself?
Yes. Every year we talk about how you don't see these kinds of warning labels in other countries. Well, this year we have a warning label that helps us illustrate that. The warning label on that pen that says pen caps can obstruct breathing, keep out of mouth, appears only in the English translation that come with the instructions for that pen. The instructions are written in English, French, German, and Spanish, and there's a whole page for each language. But the only language that has this wacky warning label is English, which says to me that the only country that this manufacturer knows it has to worry about being sued in is America. You know, some people will say, and we get this from reporters a lot, is, well, isn't it good to have a warning label on there just in case somebody does something stupid? Well, the warnings have become so long that a lot of people are ignoring warning labels and they're not reading the ones that they need. And the other point is that people are going to do careless and silly things no matter where they live, whether it's the United States, Germany, Japan, or Australia. So Americans are no more prone to swallow a pen cap than anybody else in the rest of the world, but we're the only ones that have to be warned because of that fear of litigation.
Wow. The contest, these are the nominees or the finalists. You actually decide the contest when?
The contest cash prize winners will be announced in June. They'll be selected by a national TV audience. And right now we're announcing the five finalists.
Okay. I got to tell you, we love having the segments that you have on the show. The Let's Be Fair segment. The one that really got me was the one where you mentioned the fact that you don't see seesaws anywhere anymore. And it's just a children's parks nowadays. You remember the monkey bars?
Yeah, you don't see a lot of those.
The thing I find interesting about the monkey bars is the only place I see those now are in Al-Qaeda training films.
And they're not worried too much about lawsuits, are they?
Exactly.
You know, a lot of these things that people hear us talking about sound so outlandish that people may think that they're really urban legends. And I want to tell your listeners that if they'd like to see these actual products, they can go to our website, which is centerforamerica.org. And see that all these labels are indeed real. We go to great lengths to verify every one of them.
So the website is centerforamerica.org. I thank you very, very much, Bob, for being on the program with us once again.
It's always a pleasure.
Bob DiRigo-Jones, radio host and author of Remove the Child Before Folding, 101 Stupidest, Silliest, Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, which is published by Grand Central Publishing. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0092, and you'll find links to Bob's website. And coming up right now, this week's edition of Let's Be Fair. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. The five wackiest warning labels in the United States were announced recently in the 14th annual Wacky Warning Label Contest, organized by my colleagues and I at the Center for America. The warnings are as outrageous as ever, but this year we found something new. A pen that came with instructions written in four languages had a wacky warning label about being careful not to swallow the cap. But that warning appeared only in English. Now, let's be fair. English-speaking people aren't any more likely to swallow a pen cap than Spanish, German, or French-speaking people. So, why didn't the pen maker include that common-sense warning in the other languages, too? Well, product makers know that the only place in the world where there's a high risk that they'll be sued when someone swallows a pen cap or does something else careless is in America. This litigious reputation has certainly given us some pretty funny labels to laugh at, but the high cost of these frivolous lawsuits is no laughing matter. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do have with us on the program Stuart Nauman. It's another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo.
Well, that's good to hear. You know what? TV still has a lot of power when you least expect it, actually.
Oh, really?
When it comes to books.
How so?
Well, I was at Indigo Bookstore just a couple of weeks ago, and the manager told me that Game of Thrones, you heard about that HBO miniseries.
Right.
Now, a week after the first episode aired on HBO Canada, the four books that make up George R. R. Martin's series that inspired the miniseries basically shot to the top of the store's 25 books of the week.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah, not bad, huh?
Are you watching it?
No, but he did convince me to buy book one, so I'm going to start that eventually. So that's probably on the summer reading list right now.
Okay. Meanwhile, what do you have for us this week?
Well, speaking of conflict and fighting over things and all that, battling, well, we have a book about Montreal's Irish Mafia, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, you know, they battled over things, too, with not amongst themselves, but other factions, actually. Now, since 1950, the seamy, violent world that is the Montreal crime scene was dominated by three groups, the Italian mob, the biker gangs, and the Irish mob. Although there have been many books that have chronicled the illegal exploits of the first two groups, it is the Irish that get the attention in journalist Darcy O'Connor's latest book, Montreal's Irish Mafia. The book is practically an encyclopedia of Montreal's Irish underworld, who were best known as the West End Gang, and were a product of the rough, poverty-laden streets of Montreal's Point St. Charles and Griffintown districts. Whether it be Frank Pertula, Dooney Ryan, Billy McAllister, Gerald Maddox, or Alan Ross, running the mob from their haunts along the restaurants, motels, and bars along the Saint-Jacques Street Strip, the West End Gang involved themselves in practically every type of illegal activity and allied themselves with every group of criminals that pervaded Montreal since the 1950s. Like their compatriots in the Montreal underworld, they began to violently eliminate their rivals and those who flipped to become informants for the police and the RCMP. Now, they like to hire a lot of outside help for this. One of them was former biker, Yves Apache Trudeau, who Darcy O'Connor said was a psychopath because he carried out 53 hits for the West End gang and liked to use a lot of explosives. And how did he get to use explosives so well? Well, he worked for CIL, a company that manufactured dynamite and detonators. In fact, he took some plastic explosives and put it on a TV and VCR as one way of wiping out one of their enemies. So if you're looking at TV or VCR, sometimes you got to be careful back then. But, you know, for many of the former gang members that spoke to O'Connor were actually very agreeable. They wanted to actually speak with O'Connor. You know, he didn't have to face any danger of, you know, whether it be like what happened to what Michel Auger, who wrote about the biker gangs. In fact, Alan Ross told O'Connor to get the story right and look forward to reading the book, actually. Now, Montreal's Irish Mafia is a book that will certainly thrill and fascinate true crime buffs. Even Alan Ross will be impressed. And O'Connor's encyclopedic knowledge of the history of crime in Montreal since 1950 certainly shows through in this book, as he steadfastly details the activities, both illicit and violent, of the West End gang and its Italian, Jewish, and biker colleagues. In fact, his description of the 1976 Brinks heist, in which over $2.8 million was stolen, reads like a well-crafted thriller novel. It certainly brings to light the colorful assortment of bank robbers, safecrackers, drug traffickers, and hitmen who made up one of the most powerful and violent gangs in the history of the Montreal criminal underworld. It's quite an interesting book, let me tell you.
You know, it's interesting. Just on this program about, oh, 3-4 weeks ago, back on show number 0089, I did an interview with someone talking about the underworld, but not Montreal's underworld, Boston's underworld. Harry Carr has a book out called Hitman, The Untold Story of Johnny Martorano.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his best-selling book now. That's just out. So there's a lot of crime books out there, and they do very well. True crime books.
Oh, yes, exactly. And if you like to read about crime or true crime, I have a couple of quick suggestions. First of all, you got to read The Godfather by Mario Puzo. I mean, you've seen the movie 1,000 times, and the first two are great movies. But the book really digs a little bit deeper than the movies, and especially about the psyche and the raison d'etre of the Corleone family. And I, you know, even though it was published more than 40 years ago, it still reads so well. So I do recommend The Godfather by Mario Puzo. And also, Mike Dash wrote a book called The First Family a couple of years ago, which deals with the origins of the Italian mafia in the United States in the early 20th century, and basically how the organization developed from its Sicilian roots. And, you know, the violence was, you know, just as brutal and primitive sometimes, but shows how basically that structure of the Italian underworld in the United States had its roots in Sicily and brought it to New York around 1890-1900. It's really a fascinating book.
And this week's book is?
The Montreal's Irish Mafia by Darcy O'Connor, published by Wiley. It's in paperback and it's $24.95.
And how can people get in contact or find you, Stuart?
Well, they can find me every week in the West End Times, published every Saturday. You can see me in print, or if you can't get your hands on the printed copy, just go to www.westendtimes.ca. And that's where you can find me.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're getting close to the home stretch, getting close to the idiot of the day, but I have a few more Stuff File news stories to do and share with you before we get to that point. We're racking up quite a list of when not to call 911, like when your wife won't let you have the TV remote, or when your mom won't let you play video games. And apparently we can add, just because you want a beer. In Bridgeport, Connecticut, 65-year-old Raymond Roberge called 911 and asked the dispatcher if he could get him a beer when police arrived at his home after his third call to 911 for a beer run. Raymond then asked the officers if they could get him some beer. Sadly, Ray kind of has a bad habit of doing this. According to police, he has called 911 on 79 separate occasions this year alone. And we're not even halfway through it, folks. Each call was a false alarm. On one of those calls, he offered emergency personnel $20 and a handful of loose change if they would just come and hang out with him. Wow, dude, get a dog or join a social network. Meanwhile, when Irish expatriate Andrew Short, age 38, of Flemington, Victoria, Australia, came home from a pub, he decided it was the right time to move his beehive onto the roof of his house. So he donned his bee suit and went to work. At midnight, he noticed some bees on his veil. Now here's a quote. "And then I realized he's not on the outside, he's on the inside." Startled, Short bumped the hive, and all 8,000 bees swarmed, with about 60 invading his suit. "I was up the ladder holding the hive, so the job wasn't done yet," he said. "But once they started stinging him, he thought it was best to get back onto the ground." An ambulance took him to the hospital with about 60 stings to his upper body. "A few beers, maybe, and a ladder," Short summarized. "It's a bad combination." Wow, usually those are the victim's last words, but this guy lived to tell the day. Anyway, a shopper at a mall store in Birmingham, West Midlands, England, wasn't fooled by the disguise. She reported to clerks that she saw a man disguised as a mannequin in the women's washrooms. Store securities detained Joel Hardman, age 22, a master's student at the University of Birmingham, who admitted, "Yes, I've been a bit weird." The bearded guy had a wig and a mask and said the sounds of women using the toilet were exciting to him. Yikes. He pleaded guilty to observing another person doing a private act and is awaiting sentencing, which the judge warned could include jail time, where his learned ability to blend in and remain very still could be to an advantage. And Robert Norton Kennedy, age 51, of Little River, South Carolina, lives by the motto, "With God, all things are possible. God loves you. Please forgive me if I say or do anything stupid. Thank you." Kennedy came to the attention of the Horry County Police when neighbors called them saying Kennedy had been playing loud music all day and verbally assaulting them. When officers arrived, Kennedy allegedly spat into a neighbor's face, which led to his arrest for assault and battery. And by the way, how do we know about Kennedy's motto and what it might be? Well, because it's tattooed across his forehead and clearly visible in his resulting mugshot. Wow. Well, I'm sure by now he's been told that he did indeed do something stupid. And speaking of stupid, it's time for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
Harold Lucan, age 45, was arrested on April 8th in New York City near a Bank of America after his attempted robbery failed badly. According to police, Lucan walked in at 1:50 p.m. and announced that he had a gun and intended to rob the place, but then merely got in a line and said he would wait for a teller. When he finally got to the window, with police apparently on their way, Lucan restated his intention and, as if narrating, announced the handing over of the robbery note. When the teller refused to respond, Lucan asked to check the balance in his own account, but the teller again declined, provoking Lucan to walk away and shout, "Okay, I'll go over to Citibank and rob them instead." He was arrested minutes later. Now, I'm someone who talks for a living, and even I don't narrate my own life. Well, most of the time anyway, but I digress. Why would someone walk into a bank, announce a robbery, wait in line, and then loudly broadcast each idiotic move in his repertoire of demands? One reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0092. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0092. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of...
Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.